Good evening. At this time, K2RIW and K2KEY, Rich, Dick, and Mel, respectively, start something we call the TechNet. It's been around since 1982. And I'm probably Mel, too. I'm just kind of amazed that it still exists that long. And it really is a demonstration of the fact that ham radio is a little bit more complicated than any of us thought it was going to be when we got into the hobby. So we meet in this frequency every Sunday and try to answer each other's questions and find out how Mother Nature makes this strange stuff called wireless really work. That's what gets us here. Subjects that are appropriate to the TechNet are anything that would be of interest to radio amateurs. And they're a pretty experimental group, so that includes all kinds of electronics. Not exactly a ham radio transmitter every single time. We sometimes get into low-scan television, fast-scan television, high-definition television, video cassette recorders, all kinds of things like that related to wireless electronics. Cell phones, we discuss those. Now, the way a person signs into the technical net is to give Mel and me your call letters, your name, and a confirming yes. And the yes means you do have a question or a comment for the net. So as I often use as an example, a signing would sound like this. N2EO, Rich, and yes. Do we have any check-ins? Please give me a call at this time. K2RIW. My name is Dick.
K2ILP. Rob. Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
CDO Mobile. Yes. Also.
And CL. I wonder who that could be. Could be Andy. Okay. I did get Bob, ILP. Another younger voice. Who was that other person?
It's not a young voice. K2MLB. Frank.
David, you're going to have to say your call letters a little bit more. And MLD, we got you. David, you're going to have to say your call letters a little bit more slowly and a little louder. So give it to me again, Dave.
Okay, sorry.
Okay, is that Kilo Charlie 2, Quebec X-ray Kilo? Is that what you said, David?
Correct.
Okay, we got you on the list. Bob, ILP, what was the rest of the call letters?
That is KC2, ILP.
Okay. And Mr. MLD, I should know your name. Tell me once again. Is it Frank?
Yeah, it's Frank. MLB, Major League Baseball.
Okay, we got you. I think there was Andy of the ATCDO. Who have we missed so far? We've got Bob, Dave, Andy, and Frank. Who have I missed?
KP10. Yes, Bob.
Okay, we got some guy named Barry. And Bob, KB1, give me the rest of the call letters, Bob.
OQD, Dick.
Okay, Oboe, Quebec, Delta. And Barry, anyone else want to check in?
WB2HWW, just want to know if you got the email.
Sure did this time. You got the right address on it. Okay, let's start off with the very first person. Well, I think it was Bob. KC2, India, Lima, Papa. Go right ahead, Bob.
Thanks, Dick. I recently was trying to recreate one of the old diode radios. Very simple. And the instructions were that it could work, it was called a foxhole radio. It could work with a razor blade and a pencil lead to create the diode. And all the rest are the same as the diode radio, a coil, a ground, and an antenna, and a headphone. I understand the operation of the diode radio. What I didn't understand, and I'm having trouble with, is creating the diode, the rectifier, from the razor blade and the pencil lead. It says you have to fiddle with it till you get it, but this has been 3 days of fiddling, and I haven't gotten it. I wonder if you could tell me if there's anything I need to be doing. I understand the razor needs to be blue or blued because the bluing is an oxide, and alternatively, rust is another type of oxide, a red oxide, that would work also. I don't happen to have a rusty razor blade, but I understand that's how they did it in the foxholes. Dick, any idea of what else, what I can try? Thank you.
Okay. Very fine, Bob. Brings back some pleasant memories. Roughly 1948, living in Farmingdale on Yoakum Avenue. My father and I built the crystal set following an article in Popular Science or Popular Mechanics magazine, not sure which one it was. And it was a razor blade and a cat's whisker in our case. And we had to fiddle and fiddle and fiddle for a long time with the cat's whisker, which really was a kind of a sharp metal point on the end of a movable gadget, which made contact with the razor blade. And after many days of fiddling, we did get the razor blade to work very briefly for a short period of time, and it was so troublesome, we went over to Edmund Scientific or whoever was available at the time and bought a real piece of galena. And galena and cat whisker did make a much, much better diode. Galena is a kind of a semiconductor. So the fact that your pencil lead and razor blade doesn't work very well doesn't surprise me, Bob. Been there, tried that, and it's extremely troublesome. As I said, with a sharp metal point on the blue razor blade, Gillette razor blade, we just barely made it work. It is my guess that with pencil lead, and depending on the hardness of the lead and the contaminants that are in it and whatever, I got a gut feel that the pencil lead is about 5 or 10 times more difficult to work with a razor blade to make a diode than is the cat's whisker. My recommendation is you give up on that portion of it and put in a real, let me think now, 1 in 82, I think, is a popular model number, and maybe Barry will tell us what's a popular number these days for an old-fashioned, germanium crystal diodes went on a much lower voltage, and nowadays there probably are some super good Schottky diodes. The main thing you and I care about, I believe, Bob, is that by passive means, in other words, using no battery, no active amplification, and as long as you don't live in the backwoods somewhere, as long as you're within reasonable distance of an amplitude-modulated broadcast station, somewhere between 0.5 megacycles and 1.5 megacycles, you know, 500 to 1500 on your AM dial, as long as you live in reasonable distance of one of those, like if you lived a few miles away from WHLI in Hempstead, for instance, boy, it'd be a lot of fun. The fact that you take a simple coil of wire, a diode, a simple antenna, you string out the backyard, a set of earphones, sensitive earphones, and you passively get enough power to run that whole system with no active gain, that alone is a lot of fun. And to go the next step and really go fishing with super light fishing line, so to speak, and try to make it work on a phony diode, a makeshift diode out of a razor blade and a pencil lid, I'm not convinced that it's worth the effort. Yes, you're duplicating what supposedly guys in the foxhole who are very electronically savvy did during World War II, supposedly. But I think the materials they had to work with then, I'll bet you the hardness of the lead and the contaminants that were in the lead were very, very different. For all I know, the lead was a different diameter, a different thickness, held with a different kind of holder, held tightly, and so on. And so it's a darn many things that have to be going just right in order for the lead and razor blade to give you even a mediocre diode, as opposed to 50 cents or $1.50's worth of modern-day Schottky diode or an old-fashioned germanium diode. I'm not convinced that I would work on that part of it. I'd have more fun making the radio work and experiment with the antennas. I'm going to pass it over to Barry if he's available, N2NB. I bet you he can make a suggestion of who makes a good low-voltage diode these days. N2FB with a really crazy question for you, Barry. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Leo, Dick, I got a suggestion for him.
1M34A.
Okay, that's a good one. 1M34A. Is that the one you would use, Barry? And Rich recognized that. Barry, is that the one you would use? Okay, Barry, you've got very good audio, a very good RF. But your audio is 20 decibels low. Sounds like you're talking into the back of the mic. Rich, 1M34 is a beauty. Have you got an even better one, Rich? Go ahead.
Got a modification.
Okay. We'll take Rich first, and then some guy named Mel after that. Go ahead, Bob. Here we go. Rich.
Okay, Dick. What I was going to suggest is you go online, there's a company called Antique Electronic Supply in Tempe, Arizona. They have all types of galena crystals, antique parts, copies of antique parts, new old stock antique parts. You can get a galena crystal and cat's whisker from them. Gadzik?
Okay, yeah. It sounds like Barry, and Barry, your audio is very low again. Let me pick up Mel first and then Barry in that order. Mel, go ahead.
Okay, this is K2KEY. That experiment with the razor blade was improved upon, and a lot of people don't know about it. Towards the end of the war, in Stars and Stripes, I once saw the article, which, I think I still have. My uncle had saved it for me because he was in communications. The whole story about him. They're in Germany and one of the first camps back on the air. Anyway, he, so of course knowing about radio, he saved an article, an improvement on that. And what they did, you took a piece of wood, small piece of wood block, and you stapled or nailed a razor blade each side of wood block. And then you put the lead carbon piece of material across the two razor blades, and you just rolled it gently with your finger so you got it to be sensitive to it. That was a great modification, over.
Interesting. Sounds like you get twice as many chances. Barry, you're going to have to eat that microphone and give us your report. Into Mike Bravo, I think it's mobile. K2LIW, in the group.
Okay, no, I'm not mobile. Just using a different mic right now. Yeah, you know, it's funny how you guys always steal my thunder. I had it down. I was just going to say, when I was a kid, I did it with two razor blades and a piece of, stuck on a piece of wood, just like you said. And I don't know why it worked better, but it worked better. That also doubles as a microphone, by the way. You can make a microphone out of that. The thing in World War II is two different factors. First of all, today's razor blades, I think, were made of stainless steel, most of them, and the ones in World War II were not, and they probably could rust very easily. And the other thing is the pencils probably had real lead in them, whereas today's pencils have mostly carbon. They're not really lead pencils. I don't know why they called them that. Anyway, that said, I have a question. Do we have time for my question, or do you want to get back to it later? Over.
We do have a couple guys ahead of you, Barry. If we take them in order, just the fairway. Tell me, though, if you've got an obligation coming up where you think you won't be able to hang in there for the time your question comes up.
No, I should be here. I should be here. In fact, I should even have a better microphone by that time, and 2MB.
Okay, that mic you're using now is quite a bit better. Okay, so as you can see, Bob, interesting project you've got there, and the modern-day materials, I think, is the major causative agent to your having difficulty. I'm not convinced you should concentrate on the razor blade as the diode. The rest of the radio, the fact that it can passively receive, is the non-interesting to me, and then you can then further up with experiments and diodes, on the antennas, and ways of tuning the antenna. Ordinarily, a simple crystal radio will pick up whatever the strongest radio is, but I think there are ways that you could tune the coil to favor a particular radio, and maybe you'd be able to tune to first WHLI in Hempstead, and then the Huntington station after that, or a New York City station. That would be a lot of fun. Short antenna, long antenna, better ground. There's all kinds of other experiments with passive radio. And it's amazing how history is repeating itself. If you study RFID, radio frequency identification devices, they are essentially very elaborate, very modern-day crystal radios. No battery on board. You squirt the signal at it. It rectifies enough of the signal to charge up a capacitor to about 1 volt. The capacitor becomes a temporary battery. It runs the integrated circuit chip, and the integrated circuit chip just modulates its impedance across the dipole antenna that it used to pick up the signal. That modulated impedance on the dipole changes the amount of signal it reflects back to the reader. The reader looks at that various reflection, interprets it, gets a 96-bit code out of that, and so with a lot of bits of information. You know what chip you're reading, and you're going to be hearing a lot of those things in the future. There are even enthusiastic people burying them under their skin so they can be identified. So back to you, Bob, and see if you've got any other further questions. Interesting question. KC2ILP, K2RIW in the TechNet. I'm Dick.
Leo, Dick.
Hang in there, Bob. Rich. Go ahead, Bob.
Dick, that was great. Thank you. I have done the two razor blades with the lead across. I was fortunate enough to have some of the old Gillette razors. Actually, they aren't Gillette, but they are the blued two-sided razors from an old pile, a little container I had in the shop from 100 years ago, before my time. And I did use a 1N34, and it worked beautifully. I was shocked. It was the first time I had done it in a lot of years. First time I did it where I understood what was going on, and it was incredible. And the challenge is greater than the joy of doing it. The razor blade challenge has got me. I am hooked, and like an obsessive compulsive radio operator, I am going to make it work. Matt, I thank you so much for your answers. And also that RFID you were talking about, I believe there was a successful Russian surveillance device that was placed in a U.S. embassy, and it was passive. If they beamed a signal at it, it would resonate and play back the sounds in the room. I believe that's similar to what you just described.
Absolutely. It turns out that I have worked with a man who spent a significant portion of his life trying to remove all of the bugs that were placed in the American embassy in Moscow. Boy, does he have hair-raising stories. And yes, all kinds of passive chunks of electronics have been used throughout history to pick up audio within a room without having a battery on board. And so some of the modern-day RFID is the fallout of that early, let's call it research. Funny way to call it research, but we've come a long way, and you haven't seen yet nothing yet. RFID is going to go in all kinds of crazy places you wouldn't believe to control supply chain management, make sure that automatic inventory takes place in your clothing stores and a lot of other stores. Things will be ordered just in time. I mean, it's been easily discovered that when a person goes to a store and they don't have your favorite style or your size, and it's the second time you're in the store and they don't have your size, you tend to give up on that brand and say that H with them, I ain't coming here anymore. I'm going to a store that's got my size. I don't care if they're a little bit more expensive. I don't want to waste my time. So there's a strong motivation these days for stores to be able to know when something is running low, and RFID tags are going to definitely help that. As you do further experiments with either your old-fashioned non-stainless steel razor blades, one or two pieces of lead, different kinds of lead, and whatever, come back next week or the future weeks, Bob, and let us know how your crystal radio high technology, and that's only I'm only half kidding when I say high technology, how well it's working. Glad to hear from you, and come on back. I know Rich had a couple of more words for you. Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, Dick, what I wanted to comment on is there's a company in Tempe, Arizona called Antique Electronic Supply. You can look them up on the internet. They've got Galena crystals, Gat whiskers, Very Compass, Very Ominous, antique tubes. A lot of the stuff is new old stock. Some of it is copies of old stuff. They've got all kinds of stuff that would interest him. Yeah, Dick?
Good thing to know, Rich. Thank you. Okay, speak a little bit louder and a little bit slowly, Dave, and go right ahead with your question. KC2QXK, K2RIW. My name is Dick. You got it, Dave.
Hey, thank you. I actually am having a transmission problem, not like there's any electricity problems or anything, but I have been trying to use Vox, and I have not been able to get it on the air. Can you answer that question for me?
Yeah, Vox, or voice-operated relay, I guess modern-day rigs, Dave, have a function like that, I guess handy talkies tend not to have it. Base station rigs tend to have it. And if you are reading the owner's manual very carefully, and sometimes it's got to be interpreted because it's written in Japanese modified English, Japanese English as some people call it, to turn on your voice-operated relay requires the proper gain setting of the microphone circuit. I can tell by how loud I am not hearing you that I think your microphone circuit on your particular transmitter right now could be set kind of low, or maybe the microphone is a little bit damaged and not putting out as much audio. So to make Vox work, you have to have enough audio. That's the first thing. Second thing, there usually is a Vox gain control that makes it turn on. Then on really good rigs, there's also a Vox hold control that determines how long the voice-operated relay will stay in the transmit mode after you stop talking. So there's a Vox sensitivity, a Vox hold. There's also an anti-Vox circuit, in other words, and sometimes you have to have a gain control on that. Yeah. A person who's using voice-operated relay the first time, he realizes that if the sound is coming out of the loudspeaker, and he's got the gain on the receiver set up kind of high, the sound out of the loudspeaker will false alarm the Vox, put the transmitter in the transmit mode, then the loudspeaker goes quiet, and the receiver goes back into the receive mode, and it keeps flipping back and forth. So they've made an extra circuit that measures how much sound is coming out of the loudspeaker and tries to cancel that so as not to false alarm the Vox. I think you're going to discover, Dave, that each one of us likes Vox in the beginning. The fact that we can walk to a microphone, just start talking, and the transmitter automatically goes on. It sounds like a lot of fun. There's a couple of problems with it, and that is the best voice-operated relay circuit will always have some delay to it. Somebody, when you start talking, will always miss the first syllable or the first word. Second of all, anybody making noise in the room, a dog barking or whatever, turns your transmitter on. You hit your finger with a hammer and you start cursing out loud, and all of a sudden the automatic transmitter turns on and everybody hears what you're saying. So most of us have discovered that voice-operated relay is more trouble than it's worth, and we stop using it. We all go over to the push-to-talk switch. And there's one exception to that. If you have an extremely good soundproofed helmet and you're riding in your motorcycle and your hands are very busy on both handlebars controlling the brakes and the switch and the throttle and everything else, you don't have a free hand. In that particular environment, to just talk and have the transmitter automatically go on while you're holding a QSO on your motorcycle, or if you're an astronaut and you just simply start talking while you're very busy and you're wearing a spacesuit, voice-operated relay is kind of handy in those environments. But even then, the person makes some kind of a sound like coughing or saying in order to turn the Vox on before he really starts talking so that the first word doesn't get missed. So, as I said, it's fun to experiment with, but I wouldn't put a lot of effort into it if it gives you a lot of trouble, because except for a couple of rare circumstances, you probably will eventually stop using it because it's got quite a few annoying characteristics. That's an opinion. You may like it, and that's your choice, Dave. KC2QXK for any other comments. Talk loud enough, Dave. K2RIW.
Okay, thank you. I will look at the owner's manual and see if I can get it to work. I will probably come back on next week with news if it's working. Thank you for the suggestion, though.
Okay, and so good luck with that. It's fun to play with it at first, but I think you will probably abandon it. At least many of us have. Frank, K2MLB, what would you like to talk about, sir? K2RIW and the TechNet.
Yeah, K2RIW and the TechNet, K2MLB. Dick, I had kind of an academic question rather than a problem question. So if Barry's mobile, there's no problem. Let him go ahead and I'll wait till he's finished.
No, I'm not mobile tonight. It's okay. I'm in my house tonight.
Go ahead.
Okay, fine.
Go ahead, Frank. We like academic questions, particularly about...
One quick question here before that. I'm using a different rig, and the mic gain just has a low, medium, and high, three positions. I'm in the medium. Does it sound all right on FM, or is it over-deviating?
Not over-deviating. Just about right to me. Go ahead, Frank.
Okay, fine. Well, you know, this goes back to, you know, the tower that I want to shunt feed and the fact that we know we need a very good ground system, etc. And, you know, this is primarily on 80 and 160 where you just can't get a dipole high enough to get a low angle. Gee, I want to say angle of radiation, but now you've got me sensitive to using that word radiation. We want the main lobe to be low. Anyway, with the vertical and looking into the grounds and types of grounds and so forth, I saw a table of, you know, conductivity of different type of earths and salt water, you know, as we know, was fantastic, like 5,000 or something, and then rich pastoral loam was maybe in the 30s or 40s, and average soil was 7 or 8 or 10, and desert even less, and then it gets down to the bottom of 1, I guess is the diamonds per meter, but anyway, cities and heavy industrial was 1, which was very, very poor, and I was surprised to see that fresh water was right there at the bottom of the list, as just 1 compared to 5,000 for salt water. Now, I know there's other things, what, dielectrics, permittivity, etc., but maybe to me conductivity was such a thing that I used to think was significant with telling you how good your ground was. So then anyway, looking into another table where, you know, I just wanted to look at low angles, hoping that what would give you the lowest angle of radiation for your main lobe, and they had a very interesting table on the pseudo-Brewster angle, which you would want to be as low as possible. And again, salt water, you know, was just terrific down, almost flat, maybe 1 or 2 degrees. And then very good ground was, I don't know, 5 or 6 degrees, and average ground was 10 or 15, and then very poor ground, like deserts and mountains, was 20 or whatever, and at the bottom of the heap, the industrials, or the very poor areas of city that had high buildings and heavy industrial, you know, had an angle of around 30 degrees. However, then I look and see fresh water, and I see that the Brewster angle for fresh water is like 5 or 6 degrees, almost as good as salt water, and better than every other kind of ground. So that seems to be the opposite of what I would have expected, and I guess my question is just, why would fresh water be such a terrible conductor at the bottom of the heap with the worst possible ground, and yet have such a great pseudo-Brewster angle, second only to salt water, unless this gets into reflectivity or something that has nothing to do with it. Anyway, that's the question, and if you can tell me in simple terms that I can understand, I would much appreciate it.
Okay. The first thing you're going to have to do, you and I are going to have to do, Frank, is to admit that whoever, he, capital H, or whoever, Mother Nature, or random variables of the universe, or evolution, whoever created water did some extremely strange things. It is a peculiar, ubiquitous material. It wasn't native to this planet. The strongest belief of astronomers right now is that water arrived as a product of asteroids and meteorites. In other words, things that were chunks of junk floating around in space contained water, and where that came from is still a mystery to me, but all the stuff that's falling on the Earth gave us the water that we now have, and lots of it, thank goodness. Water is a strange substance that when it goes down to 4 degrees centigrade, which I'm not sure what that is, I'm going to guess it's around 38 degrees Fahrenheit, is where it has the maximum density. In other words, it keeps contracting as you get colder until it gets to 4 degrees centigrade, and you start cooling it more than 4 degrees centigrade, and the darn stuff starts expanding again. Why the hell does it do that? If you have really pure water with no minerals in it, it is an extremely good insulator. But to get water that pure, it has to be denatured, distilled, doubled, whatever. You got to do a whole lot of fancy things to get rid of every little bit of mineral matter in water to really see its high resistance. And it's an extremely low conducting material when it is very pure. Put the slightest amount of salt or any other mineral in it, and you start getting ions. In other words, the salt dissolves into the water, and the salt decides to break itself up into sodium and chloride, and so you get positive and negative charged items in there, and you put two metal pieces into the water, and you put a battery between the two, and you get all kinds of fancy action. Oxygen out of one terminal, hydrogen out of the other terminal. deposition of metal between the two, electroplating takes place, all kinds of action. Water has got two or three other extremely strange characteristics. Water has a dielectric constant of 81. Let me run that by again. 81. Air is 1. Teflon is about 2.3. FR4 boards, and your inexpensive printed circuit boards, they have a dielectric constant of 2 or 3. In other words, you put it in between the plates of the capacitor, piece of Teflon, and the capacitor goes up 2.5 times in capacitance. You put water, pure water, between the plates of the capacitor, and the capacitor goes up 81 times higher. Strange stuff. And so, because this dielectric constant is so high at most of the RF frequencies, that's part of the reason why this booster anger acts so very differently, in my opinion. And maybe some people who are deeper into physics than I am are going to give us some corrections on that. Water, the water molecule is a highly dipole molecule. In other words, yes, there were two hydrogens and one oxygen grouped together. If you and I were building that molecule, we would put the oxygen molecule in the middle. We put the hydrogen molecule up at the top at 12 o'clock. We put the second hydrogen molecule down at the bottom at 6 o'clock. That's the way you and I would do it. Mother Nature didn't do it that way. She put the two hydrogen molecules 111.4 degrees apart from each other. Why that crazy number? You can go into crystallography study and whatever and try to figure that out. But because the two hydrogen molecules are on one side of the oxygen and not on the other, you end up with a dipole. So you put RF energy across the water, and each of the molecules of water spin in the direction of where they line themselves up with the hydrogens on one side and the oxygen on the other side. In other words, positive on one side, negative on the other side, and the water molecule rotates in position to try to align itself with the local E-field, and it does it at each half of the cycle of the RF energy. So as you put RF energy across water, these molecules try to line themselves up, but they always do it with a phase lag. They're always behind the eight ball. They never quite get there in time. It is that lag that creates the loss. Water is an extremely lossy material. It's a beautiful dummy load at microwave frequencies. It is the water that's doing 98% of all the cooking in your food in a microwave oven. You put food in a microwave oven alongside of a cup of water to make sure you're protecting the oven, and you put in there super dry bread that was purchased a month ago, the bread will run ice cold and the water will get hot. Put the tiniest bit of moisture in that bread, put it back in the microwave oven with a cup of water, and the bread will run hot as all hell because it's the water being heated. So when you cook food in a microwave oven, you're heating the water. When it comes to RF energy being absorbed by your body, it is the RF energy hitting the water in your body, and you're 90-some-odd% water, and that's what's absorbing the RF energy and turning it into heat. And nothing else happens that has ever been recognized of any significant factor. RF energy hitting your body turns into heat just like it does in the extreme case inside your microwave oven, where the tremendous amount of energy is being poured in a completely closed cavity, and the RF energy in the microwave oven bounces a zillion times until your food finally absorbs it. Out in free air, nothing like that would happen. If you think that the RF energy coming out of that transmitter 1 mile away from your house or 200 feet away from your house from a cell site, if you think that's going to injure you, you're absolutely crazy. Everybody thinks so, particularly in certain towns on Long Island right now that are trying to remove antennas, and I think they're very foolish, and they're getting themselves into a lot of trouble. We won't go there. So water has got all these strange properties. So now that we admit that water is the lossiest stuff that you and I can easily find at RF frequencies, in fact, the man who invented waveguides, Mr. Southworth, working for Bell Labs, I believe, roughly 1938, he made himself a piece of waveguide. He sent signals down and very happy with the way the signals got transmitted by the waveguide, which is really a piece of downspout tubing or something like that. And then he needed a dummy load. And he took his piece of downspout tubing, put it in a great big vat of water at a very shallow angle so that there's now a wedge of water inside the waveguide. And he discovered that was the world's best dummy load. The wedge of water at the end of the waveguide took all the RF energy, absorbed it, none of it reflected back. Allowed him to do all kinds of fancy experiments. So water, very, very lossy stuff until you freeze it. And then the stuff turns into an entirely new substance. You freeze water so it's in the crystalline form of ice. It goes from a dielectric constant of 81 down to a dielectric constant of 4. it goes from a huge loss tangent, because it keeps lagging in the way it moves with the dipole moment, and you go down to ice, and all of a sudden the molecule doesn't spin anymore, it's locked into a crystal lattice, and all of a sudden the loss tangent of the water almost disappears. So water in frozen form is a nice low-loss material, doesn't have any RF loss, and a very low loss tangent. That's why you take a frozen hamburger and you put it in your microwave oven, and you're supposed to set it on the defrost cycle. You try to cook the hamburger at the normal speed in your microwave oven, and you get a yucky, rubbery mess, because one tiny little piece of the hamburger melts, the water melts, and that absorbs all the heat, and all the frozen parts sit there and do nothing. So you end up with portions of the hamburger overcooked, other portions absolutely raw, and you say to yourself, what in the world is going on here? And you gotta use the defrost cycle on frozen food. And frozen food in the microwave oven is very troublesome. So, as you can see, water is a strange substance. The fact that it expands when it freezes means that the ice floats on top. A whole lot of animals that would have died are surviving. A lot of life on this planet is here because of that. And it's got this huge dielectric constant. I think that's a major factor as to why the Brewster angle seems so wrong, even though pure water with no minerals in it seems to be such a perfect insulator. That's part of what I know about water. Sounds like there's a lot of other people around with a lot more information. Strange stuff. Who the hell would ever design it that way, as I see it, Bob? Back to you, I think it's Frank. Back to you, Frank. Drag your feet a little bit, just in case we've got a couple other good physicists on board that'll straighten out some of my errors on water. K2MLB to take it with a little delay. K2RIW in the tech net. Looks like you got it, Frank.
Okay, K2RIW, K2MLB returning. Wow, well that's some things about water that I never heard and of great interest. So, well that explains the part of it. I won't even ask then. Going in the other direction, I guess, is with the conductivity of fresh water and salt water being, you know, just diametrically opposed. They both have a dielectric constant that's almost the same, and that makes me wonder why salt water doesn't react in that fashion as well. But anyway, that's very, very intriguing, and we'll think more about it, and I want to thank you very much.
Yeah, you guys may have heard that story about, I was reading the New York Times one time, and somebody was writing a story about a person having a culture shock going from the New York area down to Florida, and they said that the chances of him being happy immediately are as good as a snowball in a microwave oven. And it was a strange statement. Well, it was a winter day, and it was snow outside. I made a nice snowball, put it in my microwave oven alongside of a glass of water, ran the microwave oven full blast for 1 minute. The glass of water got hot. The snowball did absolutely nothing. I then went and got a chunk of ice out of the ice cube tray from the refrigerator, put it in the microwave oven with the glass of water. The ice cube did absolutely nothing except acquired a little bit of frost on its surface because of the water vapor that was coming off the glass of liquid water that was being heated in the microwave oven. So again, it taught me that ice is very strange stuff compared to water. And yes, you've got a darn good question. Salt water has the same dielectric constant, but huge conductivity. So I think we're slowly zeroing in, Frank, on recognizing that Brewster angle has got something to do with conductivity as well as dielectric constant. So some kind of a combination of the two affects the Brewster angle, I believe. And I've got an expert on this subject I can query, and I'm going to try to find out a little bit more about him because you piqued my interest on this one, Frank, and see what we can find out between now and then, and maybe somebody else will come along with some further information. Darn good question. Please come back with more of them. They're the kind of questions I like, Frank. Andy is thinking of getting into ham radio, and he's thinking of getting into the technical portion of it and maintaining repeaters and whatever. Boy, he's got all kinds of big plans, this guy, Andy. From A2CDL, what would you like to say, Andy? K2RIW in the TechNet.
Oh, after that dissertation, I'm lost for words. Yeah, very good, Dick. Good evening. And you know I'm always lurking in the background. Dick, I just wanted to clarify, if I'm allowed to do so, to change the subject a little bit and talk about this email that I received regarding this radar system called PAVPAWS that you're familiar with. Can I just take a little presentation about it and get your comments on this?
This is deep into the world of ham radio. Why in the world couldn't you bring that up on the TechNet? How about it, Andy?
Yeah, this may cause some controversy here. All right, well, the email that I received actually I received a number of emails. One of them stated that according to the New England Spectrum Management Council, which is the NESMC band plan, they notified MetroCorp to have repeater in this area, or in the New England area, vacate their frequencies because of this paved pause radar. Now, this paved pause radar, I'm sure you're familiar with, it's been around for a long time. There happens to be one in Massachusetts, one in Cape Cod. And I did a little Google search on this, and to my surprise, you know, they give you the specifications, and they talk about the phased array and how it works, and the takeoff angles, and all the technical parameters, which is a long dissertation. I won't go into that. But they do say the specs are the peak power. It's got 1,792 active elements at 325 watts, giving a ERP of 582.4 kilowatts, with a duty factor of 25%, and an average power and transmitter gain and so on. But what really intrigued me was the frequency. The frequency is from 420 to 450, right on our amateur band. Well, I was not aware of this. The question is, if we are secondary users for the 440 band, and this particular radar system operates on our ham band, is it possible that they could say, hey, all you repeater operators on the East Coast, of course they already have it on the West Coast, there's one in California, I want you to vacate and cease operations on repeaters. The question, maybe you can clarify this, because according to what I'm reading here, this has been around since 1975 or so. Actually, a proposal was submitted to the industry of June 13, 1975. And as I say, it goes into the locations. There's one at Otis Air Force Base in Massachusetts, one in Beale Air Force Base in California, one in Cape Cod. And actually, the one in Cape Cod in Massachusetts are the only two operating sites at this time. So maybe you just clarify on this, because this is, I was not even aware of this. And if this is the case, could that cause a potential problem for the amateurs? Dick, any comments? WHSTDO.
Yeah, lots of comments. I'm reasonably familiar with the paid pause. In the business I used to be in, I kept track of what it was doing. I believe it's a creation of the Raytheon Corporation, one of the really potent radars. And it's in the world I was living in, which was electronic countermeasures, there was a continuous war, so to speak, going on between the radar designers and the radar jammer designers. Radar jammer designers, electronic countermeasures. So you had countermeasures, counter-countermeasures, and so on. It just went on and on and on. All of a sudden, the radar designers started winning the war. And paved pause was the beginning of that win. And as such, the electronic countermeasures people have got to start doing something very, very different these days. The radar designers are winning because of what I call agile, agile, agile. And the paved pause is a beautiful example of it. The fact that it can transmit between 420 and 450 and it is frequency synthesized is the beginning of agility. In other words, that thing is so adaptable, it can move to any frequency in that region and maybe even a little bit beyond that region. It can choose the frequency during this millisecond of time that nobody is using, and they can hop to that frequency. It can put out pulses, fast rate, slow rate, long pulses, short pulses, pulses that chirp upward, pulses that chirp downward, pulses that are modulated, phase, frequency, amplitude, whatever. All kinds of Barker codes, modulation with impulse, goal codes, and so on. So the thing has the ability to transmit no two pulses in a row that are on the same frequency, on the same pulse duration, on the same rise or fall of frequency, rise or fall of phase, and whatever. When you listen to PAVE4s, as I have on my 432 receiver, lots and lots of years, it is a difficult thing to listen to because you don't think you're listening to a radar. You think somebody is randomly turning on and off lights in your house because you hear click, pop, zip, pop, click, pop, and even that's not repetitive, never twice the same, because that radar is so agile. Unless you live within an eighth of a mile of the darn thing and you aim your moonbound antenna directly at it and run key down kilowatt blasting into the poor front end of that thing, unless you do that, they're not going to get very much interference from you. There are rules on the book saying that if you are within, I think it was 50 miles, but I'm not sure of the number, of the paved floors at the Otis Air Force Base, that you might be restricted from aiming your antenna in certain directions. You might be restricted from lowering, from running more than 50 watts of ham radio power. But I think even that has not been exercised very much. Yes, we are secondary users. Yes, in theory, they could demand that we go off the band. I think the chances of that happening are very, very slim because of their agility, because of the amount of time it is used, because of the amount of interference that we do not create, and so on. I think it's very, very unlikely. We could start a panic by sending emails back and forth about the fact that we're secondary users. We've been secondary users for lots of decades. In theory, we can be kicked off. Well, the FCC tends to respond to whoever is using the frequency the most. And we are using the frequencies an awful lot. They are using it very lightly, and they have the ability to move that we don't. Much of our repeaters and our linking transmitters and whatever are all crystal controlled, carefully set up with the antenna tuned to certain frequencies, and for us to move would be a huge hardship. For the paved cores to move, all somebody's got to do is press a button on the control panel or tell the computer to go to another frequency. On top of that, PAVE4s is a fairly old piece of equipment, and some newer techniques are coming down the pike which are going to replace it, and they're not going to use that frequency band. So unless somebody has very specific information, and it's not just a rumor saying that they could do this, has someone ever really had an authoritative source that said that they are in the process of really eliminating us from even a portion of that band? I mean, the worst that might happen I could think of is they would say, please don't transmit between 437 and 438. I could see that happening. For us to be restricted from the portions of the band we're using, I think it's very unlikely, Andy. I might be a little bit naive, but that's the way I see it. W2CDL, H-U-R-I-W on the TechNet.
Okay. Yeah, I just wanted to get your opinion on it. Because why all of a sudden was this directive given to MetroCorp? Actually, it specifies frequencies from 439.125 to 441.25. And the directive stated to shut down as their repeaters because they were causing potential interference. It didn't actually say interference, it's potential interference. The radar installation near them. Why this came about all of a sudden, I don't know, but I just wanted to get your input on it. And I agree. I don't think, as you mentioned, it's going to affect us. We've been around a long time, as you know, and I just wanted to run that by you because I know that you're familiar with it. But it's interesting that their specifications falls right on our hand band. Why couldn't they choose another frequency to use, maybe a little bit below the 430 or 420 band. Don't know what's down there at this time, but I would gather there was no free space at the time to do this operation. Very interesting reading this on how the design of it and what it's used for is rather extensive. So I just wanted to run that by you. I thank you for that, and appreciate the input. I'm not worried about it at all. I just wanted to mention it because this was and is going around a bit by email. So, something to just think about. Dick, back to you, WHTDO.
K2, KEY, comment.
Mel recognized, and before I pass it over to you, Mel, you've done a good thing, Andy, to bring it to our attention. We should all keep an eye on this, so to speak, make sure it doesn't get out of hand. But I think the chances of us living more than 50 miles from Otis experiencing a similar request to vacate 439.25 to 441.25, which is what, a one-megacycle region? That's a two-megacycle region. For us to be experiencing that request, I think is awfully unlikely. Let's see what Mel's going to say. K2KEY, you got it, Mel.
Okay, years ago with the experiment that was done with the OTH system, what was the reason? I never really understood the reason. In fact, what was the frequency that the OTH system operated? Because they were very strong many times, like on 20 meters, 15 meters, 10 meters. What was the extent of their frequency range at the time, Dick, over?
Okay. There's been loads and loads of experiments on all kinds of HF and VHF and UHF frequencies for over-the-horizon radars, and a whole class of chunk of electronics is called radio science. Very innocent-sounding set of words, but in the mil-spec world of Department of Defense, it has some very specific meaning. Radio science is a kind of, I would call it the radio frequency equivalent of holography, or the radio frequency equivalent of MRI. By carefully studying the delay Doppler matrix processing technique of a very fancy receiver to the very first transmitter, you can keep track of moving objects over the horizon. So in theory, with one of these machines, somebody is driving a truck down the highway, you identify that particular truck, even though it's way over the horizon, and you keep track of that particular moving vehicle. Some of these very elaborate systems have that ability. And so for a mil-spec requirement, you can see how, particularly in a theater of war, that kind of capability could be very valuable. So lots of experiments where you either reflect off the ionosphere or you use tropoducting techniques at the VHF and UHF frequencies. You get much more range and you get much more sensitivity out of the lower frequencies. You get much higher angular resolution and fineness of detail at the higher frequencies. So a super good system would use both low and high frequencies with just the right combination and get the best of both worlds. And not too many of the installations did that because they tend to be great big things that fill up multiple acres in order to really do this kind of work. And some of the phased array techniques for using, for steering the antennas, frequency scans, phased arrays and whatever, lots of work have been done along those lines. So they're a good piece of hardware. So-called Russian woodpecker and a few of the other more extreme cases did present some significant interference that required some rather high technology blanker circuits in order to tolerate it. When the FPS-35 radar used to be operational at Montauk Point, that particular radar was capable of giving me a signal strength 120 decibels above my noise when the back of my antenna was aimed at them. I couldn't even measure what was going on when they aimed the front of my antenna at them. But I could put a step attenuator between my receiver and the antenna, and I rapidly recognized the fact that as I'm stepping the step attenuator, I'm no longer seeing any change in the signal, and I'm still hearing the signal a little bit when the main lobe would come by me. Well, the signal was so darn strong during band openings from Montauk Point to Huntington, where I live, that occasionally the signal was coming through the B-plus wiring of my 432 converter, and I was hearing them even though the antenna was disconnected. That's a potent radar. You take that potency of radar with that signal strength, and you go into a real good noise blanker that exists in, for instance, the R4C receiver, the Drake R4C, or the Kenwood 520, and probably some more modern pieces of equipment. But you get a real good noise blanker, you turn it on, and the radar is gone. Absolutely gone. Nothing is there. You don't hear it. Not even distortion when you're listening to a single sideband signal. So there are noise blankers, and there are noise blankers, and the really good ones can take out that kind of noise. You have to make sure that the noise blanker is operating way up.